the paranormal to the extraordinary, from the weird to the wonderful, this is On the Odd.
Special guest. Her interest in UFOs began in September 1961 when her aunt and uncle, Betty and Barney Hill, had a close encounter with a UFO in New Hampshire's White Mountains. She has a background in social science and education and graduated from the University of New Hampshire and then did graduate work while working as an educator. She began researching UFOs full-time in the late 1980s until the 1990s. Actually, I think that you still do UFO research.
Yes.
You've authored 3 books on the subject, 2 with Stanton Friedman, who we had the honor of speaking with just a couple weeks ago.
You must have an old bio. 3 with Stanton Friedman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on. I'm updating that right here. I apologize. So you have a total of 4 books on the subject.
Yes, and I've just completed a 5th, which will be released in 2019.
Unstoppable.
I had hoped it would be released this summer, but it's been picked up by a large publisher. So I guess that's good news, but bad news for the experiencers that I wrote it for.
More red tape, but at the same time gets printed a whole lot more.
Yes.
So, yeah, we spoke with Stanton Friedman just a couple weeks ago. He was really great. And also Denise Stoner I spoke to just a few days ago, and she was wonderful. She was excited that I was going to be able to speak with you as well.
Yes.
Please welcome to the show, Kathleen Marvin. How are you, Kathleen?
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I appreciate you taking the time out to speak with me today, and hopefully I can ask you a couple questions that you haven't been asked about the subject, but I have a feeling that you've done it all. But maybe not. I mean, you do have a 5th book coming out, so there has to be something there. Probably every day you realize more and more how deep this entire phenomenon goes.
Oh, absolutely. And how perplexing it all is, particularly the interdimensional aspect of it.
So if I could just ask you, prior to, how old were you, and I hate asking ages, how old were you, or about how old were you, when your aunt and uncle, Betty and Barney Hill, had their pretty much world famous or infamous situation, or the beginning of their experiences?
I was 13 years old when Betty phoned my childhood home, speaking to my mother, who was her younger sister, and told her about the close encounter that she and my uncle had had with a UFO the previous evening. The purpose of her call was to ask my mother to speak with a neighbor of ours who was a physicist, because she and Barney were greatly concerned that the UFO had come so close to them that they might be contaminated.
Wow. And they did find that their car had been magnetized, a number of things. But, you know, it's one of those things where, and this is 1961, so I'm thinking, you know, they're coming right off of, you know, the fears of nuclear war. They're probably still kind of imminent at the time. And, you know, we understand about radiation. We have fears of it. You know, there might be the earlier fears, but nonetheless, there are fears And they were actually smart enough to do all of that, to check that. I believe I read somewhere where this neighbor told your aunt to go and grab a compass that might have been with them. I'm not 100% or any compass. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it was spinning as they approached the car.
Let me explain that to you.
I butchered it. I apologize.
Okay. Well, I'm a real stickler for accuracy.
Oh, absolutely.
And so it just happens with almost anyone that they and I'm sure that I do it on other cases where I don't have the degree of knowledge that I have on this case. But for some reason, this neighbor of ours who was a physicist told Betty that if she had a compass, she should get it and take it out to the car to see what would happen. And of course, we know that the needle on a compass will spin when it gets close to the battery. That was not what happened. She started on the side of the car, and then she moved toward the back of the car. And this is when she noticed a group of very shiny spots that were all about the size of a quarter. Mm-hmm. And this was very perplexing because they hadn't been there the day before. But this was the exact spot where she and Barney, the previous evening, had heard a series of buzzing sounds striking the car. So what she did is she took the compass and she held it over those spots. And when she did, the needle would spin and spin. She went in and she told Barney about this. She also told the upstairs neighbors, and the man was in the military, stationed at Pease Air Force Base. And so the neighbors saw this happen as well. Barney said to Betty, "Oh, Betty, it's just a cheap compass. Forget about it." And Betty said, "But everybody else has seen this, Barney. Come see this." And so he said, "Oh, all right, I'll come out." And so he went out and he did the same thing. He held the compass over those spots. And when he did, he observed the needle spinning and spinning. So that is what occurred.
And also, you mentioned you were 13 when you learned of this.
Yes.
Did you have any type of personal accounts prior to this?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking is, you know, 13 years old, you can have a conversation with a 13-year-old. You know, you might be a wacky teenager, but, you know, you are mature enough to be able to understand things and remember them accurately.
Yes.
I have a 10-year-old who's becoming, you know, he's starting to remember things accurately. You know, but if you ask him about something, you know, that happened when he was 5 or 4, it's, you know, it's totally absurd.
Yes. And I was a pretty level-headed teenager, right, as well. I taught Sunday school. I was pretty mature. Oh, wow. When a teacher went out to have her lunch, they put me in charge of the classroom when I was in the 8th grade. You know, so I was pretty mature and responsible.
Now, your aunt and uncle's experience were not so much unlike Denise Stoner's experience. I mean, each experience is probably totally different, but it had similarities. And that's one of missing time, one of being of traveling a distance in a blink of an eye.
Yes.
And it kind of seems almost the same distance, too, I believe. Denise Stoner's distance was about 40 miles and your aunt and uncle were 35.
That's correct.
I wonder if there's something to that. I don't know. But,
you know, and this was what initially interested me so much in investigating Denise's event. Mm-hmm. With her husband and daughter. Here we had eyewitnesses as well. I had two people that I could hypnotize separately, and in state amnesia with Denise until I was able to hypnotize her husband as well. So I investigated this very much the way that the Hill case was investigated.
Now, what happened to the items that they had on them. Like, I know that your uncle, they ruined his, like, a nice pair of shoes, the car itself. Was anything retained and kept that exists today?
Yes. Betty's dress was torn in several places. There was a 2-inch tear in the stitching at the top of the zipper, which ran up the back of her dress, a 1-inch tear in the thick zipper fabric. The hem was torn down on one side, and the lining was torn from waist to hemline. She placed the dress in her closet, and the next time she took it out, it was covered with a pink powdery substance. That dress has undergone scientific analysis 6 separate times,
wow,
all with anomalous findings. The dress is now in an archival collection that I set up at the University of New Hampshire.
I mean, it's really just forward thinking to even hold on to these items. As you know, like, these things are just discarded, forgotten. What about the trunk of the car? I mean, it's like, it's kind of hard to kind of archive an entire car if you're just a regular person. I restore old cars. So unfortunately, I actually have an archive of car parts. But, you know, it's probably one of those things where your uncle wasn't thinking, all right, you know what, let's save the car.
Right. And what happened is that Betty sold that car to her daughter and her daughter's husband. And he was in the military, in the Air Force. They were stationed, assigned to another base. They left Pease Air Force Base and drove the car to the next base that they were assigned to. And they eventually sold the car too, not realizing the value of checking that further, of doing a scientific investigation. The earliest investigators didn't think of doing that either. And none of us, in fact, even thought to photograph those spots, which is pretty unbelievable to me that we were so awestruck by looking at what had happened.
Well, there's so much. You know, it's not just one thing.
On photographs, yes, there was a lot.
I'm a car buff, so I just have to ask, do you recall what kind of car it was?
Oh, sure. It was a 1957 Chevy Bel Air, and it was kind of a sky blue or a royal blue color with white.
Oh, two-tone.
Yes.
It sounds like a nice car, too.
Yeah, it's a nice car.
Yeah, and it's a complete classic now, which I would love to... I mean, it wouldn't be impossible to try and track it down, but it would be very difficult.
Yes, other people have attempted to track it down and have not been successful.
Yeah, I mean, they were definitely squashing these cars in the 70s and recycling them into, you know, 1980s Hyundais. So it's essentially what happened, unfortunately.
Yes.
So they also had their watch, I believe... At least one watch stopped working at the time, and jewelry, you know,
both
things
watches.
Like that.
Yes, they had checked their watches at 10 o'clock at night. They rewound them, and when they arrived home, the watches had stopped running and never ran again.
Wow. So another thing is, you mentioned the torn dress. And
yes.
The torn dress and how it became torn is something that you brought out through hypnosis. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, but I didn't hypnotize Betty. This was Dr. Simon who hypnotized Betty. And Betty then remembered.
I love this. Because it kind of gives me this image of Betty as being kind of feisty. And not letting somebody just do what they want to do.
Yes. So what happened was that when they intercepted her from the car as she attempted to run into the woods to hide, they did something that rendered her unconscious temporarily. Mm-hmm. She woke up again as she was being taken down a path through the woods toward this landed craft. And when she saw Barney had been taken up this ramp, and she was going to be taken up, and she fought for her life. She gave the one next to her a good kick, mm-hmm. trying to get away. And this is how the hem and the lining were torn. Now, the zipper was torn at a different time. When she was being examined, the examiner decided to remove her dress and apparently did not know how to unzip a zipper. And so the stitching and the fabric was torn at that point. By the time they got to Barney, who came second in his examination, they had learned how to unzip a zipper.
Right.
So the fly of his pants was not torn. But that is how Betty's dress was torn. And she remembered all of this as a result of having had hypnosis. It's not in the hypnosis transcripts, but when you have hypnosis, you remember far more than you state.
Yeah, hypnosis is one of these things that I think is phenomenal for a lot of people. Personally, I don't know of any encounters I've had where I would need to, I think, go to hypnosis and try to recount. But if there were things, I would certainly turn to it. Did the hypnosis bring out how long it might have been that they were held by? And also, you're referring to the people, the entities as they. Do we have a focus of whether they were grays or there's so many different theories as to the different entities. And I'm just kind of curious if they were like the stereotypical, I hate saying stereotypical, but the the conventional gray, where it's the, you know, kind of bulbous head and very slender body.
Well, they were a species of gray, and not all grays are alike. There were two different types on that craft. There were the taller ones who were around 4.5 to 5 feet tall, and they all of their skin was grayish toned. They were completely hairless. They were dressed in black, shiny bodysuit kind of things. They had fairly large chests and very thin limbs. Mm-hmm. And of course, communication was telepathic. They had large eyes that seemed to wrap around toward the sides of their heads. And they were not wearing these black shields over their eyes. They were able to see a pupil. They were able to a dark iris.
I never learned that. Wow, that's really interesting.
What had been the white of a human eye was a little bit of yellow, but the iris was very large on their eyes, so it took up almost all of that eye space.
Oh, that's fascinating. I mean, the entire account is fascinating, and it's also unfortunate as these people had no idea what was going on in the early.
Well, they were terrified.
Of course. I'd be terrified today, of course. Mm-hmm. And these are not, these aren't dummies. These are people who are educated. These are people who didn't want this. These are not people who are seeking, you know, this kind of media attention. I think a lot of people need to be reminded of that. Just because, you know, just because we remember it. So, you know, and we use the account so often, it doesn't mean these people wanted any of it in their life. They just wanted to lead a normal life and continue driving down the road.
Yes, they requested confidentiality. They were willing to speak with scientists and with UFO investigators. They spoke to the family, but they swore us to secrecy. Mm-hmm. They spoke to their friends and to some military officers at Pease Air Force Base as well, and also to a retired admiral in Maine, but they did not go forward with this to make it public themselves. Right. It was done as the result of a violation of confidentiality. Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. Her job was at stake. Barney worked for the post office. His job was at stake. Barney had also been appointed to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission's State Advisory Committee in the state of New Hampshire. He had also worked with Sergeant Shriver through the Federal Poverty Program and received an award for the work that he did with Sergeant Shriver. For the good work he did for the people of New Hampshire. Betty worked by his side, but they were very politically motivated in what they did. They had very good reputations mm-hmm. in the state of New Hampshire, and they certainly did not want to be viewed as a couple of kooks who were claiming that they had been abducted by aliens.
Right. And especially at this period of time where people are so, in 1961, you're not getting very many people believing you. Not in the general public.
Oh, no, not at all. This was the first case in the United States that was investigated scientifically.
Now, Betty was, she located NICAP, and that's who she reported it to, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Is that where the violation of privacy happened?
No.
Oh.
It is not. What happened is one of her friends that she had told ended up talking to a Boston newspaper reporter. And this friend, I actually have the letter where this friend is named in a letter that he wrote to Betty and Barney asking to speak with them. And he assured them that this was only for his own personal information and that he would not exploit it in any way. And they ended up saying, no, we will not speak with you. And we don't want you to write anything about this because of who we are.
Sure.
We don't want this made public. And approximately 2 months later, after they received this letter, he wrote 5 articles in the Boston Traveler.
Wow.
Yes, they appeared 5 nights in a row. Betty and Barney came down to my grandparents' home. I grew up across the street from my grandparents in Kingston, New Hampshire. We had a big family meeting. This was very disturbing.
Of course.
What to do next? The family is affected. It's not just Betty and Barney. And we decided on that night that since the cat was out of the bag, Betty and Barney should go forward and talk about this and separate fact from fiction, because not all of the information in the magazine articles was even true. It was based, some of it was based upon hearsay.
Mm-hmm. And this happened, the actual experience in the car happened in the White Mountains in New Hampshire.
That's correct.
And they lived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, is that correct?
That's correct, on the seacoast.
And that's about 100 miles from apart. When they were doing their drive, so they had to continue driving another 60-some-odd miles, depending on where they were, actually, to home. And, you know, it's just, I can't imagine having such a traumatic experience and still having to do an hour and a half worth of a drive. You know, it's one of these kind of, like, for them to even just mentally get through that drive is amazing to me.
Yes, and Barney was looking for a police officer all along the way. They were both looking for a place where they could stop and have a cup of coffee or something. Everything was closed. They didn't realize until they arrived home that they were missing a couple of hours' time.
Wow. So this all, of course, led you to do more investigations, I'm sure. You have a social work background? Is that correct?
Yes, social work and education.
My wife is a social worker.
I did my graduate work in education.
Okay.
I was a social worker, and I'm also a certified hypnotherapist, retired.
My wife is a social worker here in New York, and it's definitely, it takes a certain person to take on the roles that you people have to do. You know, it's just one of these things where you have to have a lot of patience for people, and you have to really let them tell their story, and you have to do your best to help them. But I can imagine that this opened your eyes to just the world that's out there, in the sense of, all right, well, you know, there are a lot of people having either similar stories, less dramatic and somewhat more dramatic. So I'm thinking that your investigation took you towards that. I believe you joined MUFON in 1991.
That's
the
correct.
Mutual UFO Network. I always like to remind people that's the Mutual UFO Network. I like saying that more than MUFON.
Uh-huh.
MUFON sounds like a concert or something, but like a Lollapalooza or something. But it's easier to remember. One of the things I always liked about MUFON is that they take their investigations extremely seriously.
Yes.
They send out investigators. They do a tremendous amount of research. And I was wondering, I asked this to a number of people. I asked Stanton this, I believe I asked Denise this. I'm sorry, you're Kathleen. When you get the data, do they go over it and enter it into a massive database?
Yes.
It gets kind of like a round table of, like, this is what we have going on right now.
Yes, we have a massive, very secure database. It is called MUFON's Case Management System. And people who file reports for an investigation with MUFON fill out the form, give all of their information, and then they are contacted by a MUFON field investigator who has been assigned to this case. We also have another team, and I am the director of that team, and nationally and internationally, and that is the Experiencer Research Team. We do soft investigations. We don't do the hard science-based investigations as our team. Although most of our members are certified field investigators and do hard investigations, scientific investigations. But my team, their role is to be non-judgmental listeners to individuals. So many people who are having these experiences are emotionally traumatized. They fear ridicule.
Of course.
And they are not ready for a scientific investigation. Many of them don't have a lot of scientific evidence to present, and they are fearful that the scientific investigators are just going to go in, look for physical evidence. If they don't find it, they're going to say, well, we found no evidence that this is true. So they have the Experiencer Research Team that they can go to. The members of my team, there are 20 of us in all.
Wow.
But the members of the team are specialists in contact with non-human entities, preferably with UFOs involved. People can go to MUFON's website, scroll down to the Experiencer Research Team. They click on that, and they will come up with the Experiencer Research Team's page. Some of our members are listed on the page with our bios and our photos. At the top of that page, it says, take the Experiencer questionnaire if you would like to speak with a member of the ERT. Here I go with making a brief letters again. So anyway, they can click on that, and a 30-page questionnaire will come up. It's pretty straightforward. It's not tricky at all. And we will ask them to fill this out. It serves mostly as an icebreaker, and it gives us some insight into the kinds of experiences that they've had It's not going to tell us whether or not they are experiencers or not, but it will open up a channel for them so that they will be contacted by a member of the experiencer research team who will offer to call them or to speak with them via Skype to discuss their experiences. Now, if they are looking for a hypnotherapist, we have a list, and it's unfortunately a short list, of vetted hypnotherapists who are professionals, who have malpractice insurance, and who have experience at working with experiencers. And that's very important. It's not a good idea to just go to any hypnotist who, because you might end up being more traumatized when you come out.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Definitely somebody who's vetted and has experience with these type of situations is certainly somebody who I would rather spend time with than somebody who's taking a shot for the first time.
True. And we also have a short list of psychotherapists who specialize in this, and also some support groups. And two of those are online support groups, so we can make referrals to the online ones if people do not live near a support group. So we do what we can to help experiencers. When John Mack died, much of this just went by the wayside. And I saw a real need in 2011 when I took this position. I accepted this position when it was offered to me by the Mutual UFO Network. And I set up protocols for the investigation of alien abductions. We had not, did not have protocols in place for that. On what kind of evidence to even look for. So that's something that I did with a group of consultants. We worked about a year in developing these protocols. And then I started speaking with experiencers who completed this questionnaire, and it very rapidly grew way beyond what I could handle. And finally, today we have 18 people who are on the team who are calling individuals, getting in touch with them, speaking with them about their experiences. And then there are two individuals. I am one of them, and Dr. Don Derry is the other one. And we conduct social research, which is really my love. And we also, or I also, and Don does too, we're authors, we're writers, we speak publicly, we do radio shows, we educate the public as well.
I mean, throughout the 90s is when I came across MUFON. I think 1989, actually, I first learned that it even existed. And I worked in the mid-90s in one of these kind of holistic head shops here in New York, probably the last head shop in New York at the time. So we were essentially, we were a bookstore that carried alternative books, and we would sell the MUFON newsletter. I think we either sold it or did something where we would get them, but we would return the ones that we didn't sell each month. I'm not really sure exactly what it was, but I would thumb through it, and I was just really blown away by it. I became a subscriber probably until mid-2000, and these days I'm going to, I just have to take the time to do it and go, and I have to rejoin. I just feel as though it's one of these things that has grown. I feel as though also, you mentioned that you took on a much larger leadership role in 2011, and yes. I feel as though that was really the beginning of MUFON being also taken a little bit more seriously, at least in the general public's eyes. Right now, when you bring up MUFON, people know it's a serious organization. People know it's not for fun. It's not, oh, that's just a hobbyist type of thing. It's a legitimate source for real information.
I think that it has credibility. And a few weeks ago, I was out at AlienCon in Pasadena, California. We had 10,000 people attend each day. Mm-hmm. It was a huge convention. And I was there to work, to serve on panel discussions. MUFON, I was there because MUFON is highly respected. And even the people who produce Ancient Aliens, Prometheus, recognizes MUFON as being a credible organization.
Now, NICAP still seems to exist in some form. Does MUFON work with NICAP at all?
I'm not aware that it exists in any form.
It could be somebody just bought up the .org and threw up information. I really don't know if it's associated with anything legitimate. You know, I'm really not sure.
Okay, old NICAP files are at NICAP.org, I believe.
Okay. It's an older website, although it seems to be updated relatively often, but it's an older style website. When, you know, it's funny, because I forgot about NICAP. And when I was doing some information, I came across something you said about how Betty had contacted NICAP. I'm like, hey, I wonder whatever happened to them. And lo and behold, I find a website that is at NICAP.org. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. And who knows, maybe this will create some level of communication.
Well, NICAP was a very serious and respected organization. It was comprised of scientists, of military officers, and people who, from the general public, who had a very scientific interest in UFOs. There was a lot of hope back in 1966 when Edward Condon began to look at this more seriously with the Colorado study, the scientific study on UFOs. But by 1969, Condon, not being truthful, stated that none of this, there was absolutely no evidence that any of this was real. Oh, if you go back and you look through the government documents on the major studies that have been done by the U.S. government, you'll see that there is significant evidence that UFOs deserve scientific research, investigation, and that there already is a good body of evidence in favor of the idea that this is extraterrestrial in origin. And I'm sure that Stanton Friedman spoke to you about Blue Book Special Report number 14, the largest government study ever done on UFOs. 3,201 cases were studied in detail. And at the end, 21.5% could not be identified as anything conventional.
You know, one of my favorite things that Stanton has said, and I know he didn't just say this to me, but he said, you know, I've never seen a UFO, but I've also never seen an atom. Mm-hmm. But I know it exists. He just said there's just overwhelming information out there. And I just love you and, you know, everyone that you're associated with in Stanton. There's a certain bravado. There's a certain, well, look, go do your own research and then come back. You know, it's really almost like that. You can't be a skeptic without, I mean, you can be a skeptic, but you can't be a fair skeptic if you're not going to at least do your homework. And absolutely, have a reason to be a skeptic.
And it takes time. Stanton and I went to archival records in physical libraries. And, you know, it costs a lot of money to make those trips and to stay in the hotel and go to those libraries day after day. Sure. And really pore over all of those records. When we wrote our book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, I had been to the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia on three separate multi-day trips to acquire information on the archival records of Donald Menzel, of Edward Condon, of Philip Klass, people who we think of as skeptics on all of this. And I actually did find evidence that not only were some of them skeptics, they were actually disinformants. So you have to do your homework.
Another thing that I think that you and Stanton bring to the table when you write together anyways, having a sense of humor about some stuff, you know, not taking it so seriously that it becomes painful. You know, you can't, you know, you can create a textbook that's, you know, just the facts, or you can tell genuine accounts and have an understanding of how the real world works. And, that's something that, I felt like with Fact Fiction and Flying Saucers brings to the table. I think that you enjoy the genre, but you bring the truth and the facts that do exist to the forefront. You also yes. have a number of other books. You have The Alien Abduction Files that you wrote with Denise Stoner.
That's correct.
You also have Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, the true story of the world's first documented alien abduction, and of course that's your aunt, your story of your aunt and your uncle. These are very well received books. These are just, you know, they're really great. Could you share what the next book is about?
The one that you didn't mention Science Was Wrong.
Yes.
And in that book, Stanton Friedman and I each wrote seven chapters about something that occurred in the history of science dating back a couple of hundred years. And it involved highly educated, very powerful scientists, and sometimes the government was involved, sometimes it was the result of greed, and greed for power as well. But they made proclamations of impossibility. Sometimes there were very serious consequences for what happened as a result of these proclamations. Sometimes people's careers were ruined as a result of this. And those whose careers were ruined were the ones who were correct in the end. So what we attempted to show is that, you know, we have a very high regard for science, but we don't have regard for close-minded scientists who insist upon the zeitgeist of the old guard and are fearful of moving ahead toward discovery.
Yeah, my whole life I've always been told science is about questioning things and always questioning. As soon as you stop questioning, you're going to get bogged down with, you know, false truths. And it seems as though today's science is all about don't question science. It's about science. It's science, stupid. You know, that's what, you know, there's a lot of people out there who just love to just flat out dismiss the fact that there is evidence to prove otherwise on a number of different things that are out there. I don't want to go into too much of detail because I don't love getting hate mail from people, but you know what? I'll just say it. With global warming, I don't feel as though it's a closed case. Do I feel as though there's something going on with the environment and our weather? Absolutely. But I don't 100% support the fact that it's all our fault. And I also don't believe that money's going to fix that by using carbon credits or what's the other thing? I'm forgetting what it's called, but I don't buy into the fact that corporations can buy their way out of it by purchasing carbon credits.
Yes. No, that doesn't make a lot of sense. No. They were supposed to be putting scrubbers on their chimneys, but I don't know what happened to that. That was back when George Bush was president.
I remember that. They were going to literally put a type of filter on the stacks, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I forgot about that.
So the air would come out being fairly pure.
Like a reverse cigarette in a way.
Damage. Acid rain was of great concern.
In the 80s, yeah.
If you remember back.
I do. I remember in the 80s, acid rain was big, 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 and now it's gone. I don't know. We beat acid rain somehow. I'm not really sure. But, you know, one of the things that Stanton mentioned with all of these inventions was he had worked on a nuclear airplane.
Yes.
I mean, I'm an advocate for nuclear. I feel as though, just like all technology, it's advanced. But, you know, he's somebody who really worked on, you know, he's the real deal.
Yes.
Which is why you write books with him.
That's for sure.
Yeah, right. And he actually said so many nice things about you. He loves you. He like loves writing books with you. So I don't know if there
and
might
I,
be a
I
sixth.
Really, I love working with him as well. We have a very good working relationship. We share vendor tables when we work at conferences together, mm-hmm. and I have thoroughly enjoyed the time that I've spent writing books with him. Now that he's retiring, I'm just feeling a little bit down because we'll never write another book together. And it was such a joy. And he has such a brilliant mind and is so very, very careful about details.
Do you think he's really going to retire? I mean, he's just the type of guy who I can't really picture saying, well, you know what, I'm going to whittle. I'm going to whittle
a little. I think that he will remain interested in this topic. And I do believe that he's going to continue to write a monthly column for the MUFON Journal. Mm-hmm. But I do not believe that he's going to write another book and or travel all over the country and the world to speak at conferences. He's 84 years old.
Yeah.
Now he will be at the end of this month on the 29th. And his family has convinced him that they're concerned about him traveling at that age and that it's time for him to not completely hang up his hat, but
enjoy life.
Yes, to enjoy life, to take it at a slower pace and to do a little less, but to maintain the interests that he has.
He was so nice with us, and he was just so... just a really wonderful person, just like you and Denise. You guys, I can see why you guys work well together. I wanted to bring up on July 27th through the 29th, there's going to be a pretty big event, the MUFON Symposium for 2018. I wanted to know if you could tell us a little bit about that. And, you know, I always say us, and I have to tell people why I say us. I usually have a co-host. And Alex is, he just got married about 2 weeks ago in Vietnam.
Oh.
So he's over there for, I don't even know when he's coming back. He's 11 hours ahead of me. He actually was going to be here to speak with you, but he just doesn't work out all the time. And I can't blame him. I think it's like 1 o'clock in the morning there or something. But yeah, that's why I always say, us. But, Alex and I are actually going to try to make it to the symposium this year. So we're very excited as we're right here in New York.
That's wonderful. I hope to see you there.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have some very exciting speakers. One is going to be Luis Elizondo in the flesh. He is the former Pentagon official for the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program.
Wow.
And he is... The individual who asked through a Freedom of Information Act request to have two videos released. The one was that Tic Tac video that was disclosed for the first time on the news on December 16th.
Was that through Tom DeLonge? Was that through his organization?
It's part of... Somehow Tom DeLonge was able to put this group of scientists together, people who had worked for the federal government, including Chris Mellon, who was a consultant to the United States government for national security matters, and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Security and Information Operations. Hal Puthoff, who is a big name, he's an engineer and physicist, and he headed the CIA's Extrasensory Perception Remote Viewing Program at Stanford Institute with Ingo Swann and Russell Targ. Mm-hmm. And also Stephen Justice, who headed Advanced Programs and Technology and was former Program Director for the Advanced Systems at Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, and Jim Semovin, who was a former senior intelligence officer and CIA director of operations. So these are people who have now retired, who believe that it is time for this information to be disseminated a little bit at a time to the general public, which is very, very important, I think. Luis Elizondo is going to be there speaking about his role in all of this at Friday evening's banquet. He's going to be the keynote speaker. On Saturday morning at 7:30, there is a special event for experiencers and for field investigators. It's a paid event. But I'm going to be hosting it. It's an experiencer workshop. Oh. So I'm going to be doing a PowerPoint presentation specifically geared toward experiencers. And we're going to set aside an hour so that experiencers who want to talk about their experience in a non-judgmental environment for about 5 minutes each. Not everybody is going to have a lot of time to do this, but it's very important and very valuable because so many people have different types of experiences. We also have people like Dr. John Brandenburg, who is a scientist who worked for NASA and with NASA funding studied the surface of Mars. And he is the one who discovered evidence for two thermonuclear explosions on the face of Mars.
Oh my goodness.
On the surface of Mars. So he's going to talk about the scientific evidence that he discovered. I just cannot wait for that one. That is the one that I've been waiting for the past 3 years to hear about.
I hope people take notes because I almost feel as though if you're going to go to these lectures and I'm not going to say meet and greets, but you're basically going to have a lot of communications with people. I would say it's not as important the information that's put in front of you at that moment. It's going to be the connection with the person, getting their website and being able to read their studies. You know, it's not so much, where else can you find all of these people under one roof and find out basically the entire, information from the entire community. I think it's great.
And there is a wonderful variety of people. We have Dr. Don C. Dondari, who worked with me on this 3-year comprehensive study on experiencers. He was the psychologist statistician who administered the American Personality Inventory to evaluate abduction reports. So he's going to be speaking about that. I'm going to speak about the MUFON Experiencer Survey and what it tells us about contact and the implications for humanity's future, including the messages that have been given to experiencers by these non-human entities and also the commonalities that we have discovered that experiencers and abductees share. And we were able to identify abductees as a separate group from experiencers who have some of these characteristics at a much higher statistical rate. We also have people like Randall Nickerson, who has been investigating and producing a film on the aerial school event that occurred in 1994 in Zimbabwe. This was a religious school, and he has been working on this for many years. John Mack was one of the original investigators of this. He has Selma Siddick, who was one of those children, who is now grown up and is going to be there with him for his presentation. So that's really exciting. Travis Walton will also be there. And yes, a very big name. Lynn Kitai will be there. Nick Pope will be there. So we have some very big names who will be speaking at that symposium on a variety of different topics. And all of these people I consider to be highly credible.
You know, when I first learned of this, I thought, oh, all right, let me see where they're going to have this. It'll probably be California, you know, because the East Coast doesn't get these things, it seems. You know, we don't. We get kind of over, like, we might be the biggest city, and I'm only about 30 minutes from Manhattan, but we don't get, you know, the Javits Center full of this. And it probably has a lot to do with the fact that the Javits Center is prohibitively expensive. But for this to only be, I think this place is maybe 45 minutes from my house. You know, we're really going to try to make it, it looks as though it's one of these type of things. MUFON has done a beautiful job, not only on the website, but coming up with this entire group of professionals and experts on the subject, having different panels of discussion and special events. There is stuff that's free, too. So if somebody can't afford it, they can look it up. You can find out everything on MUFONSymposium.com.
Yes, and it's going to be held at the Crown Plaza in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who cannot afford to go to this event, for $74, you will be able to live stream the entire program, except for those paid sessions that will not permit recording. Right. Sunday morning from 7:30 to 9, I'm going to be doing another session with experiencers, and that is going to be different than Saturday's session. It's going to be on suggestions for how to end contact if you would like to end it. So I'm going to be giving 12 different suggestions that have worked for some individuals.
It seems like it's going to be a very successful symposium, and I wish you the best of luck with that. Also, if you're interested in joining MUFON in general, just the regular old MUFON, they have a number of different packages that give you different levels of membership and different levels of support. But, you know, it's all in all, you can get your foot in the door for much less than what it costs for Netflix.
Yes.
You know, and you're, you know, really helping support, an organization that is forward thinking and trying to do some of these investigations, and without it being, you know, all going into the red, because I'm sure at some point MUFON has been paid for by God knows who. You know, it's
we are a member funded organization. Mm-hmm. So our funding comes from our membership and from our symposiums, and that's it. We don't receive government funding. I know that the conspiracy theorists say we do, but we don't. We always appreciate more members coming in, mm-hmm. and paying their membership dues and helping to fund the good work that our organization does.
Yeah, and it's really, you're a real leader in the field of the investigation. I think it's really, it's important to, if you have an interest in this information coming to surface, there's no better organization to spend. I mean, you know, we buy so many things. It's just weird. Like my wife and I were going over credit card, you know, monthly recurring charges. And we're like, wow, we really don't need this, 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 and this anymore, you know. And that's why I'm considering, I really am going to join MUFON again. And I'd like to be a part of that again. So, but also if you're interested in finding out more about Kathleen Martin, you can go to kathleen-martin.com. You have a number of books that are on Amazon. I'm going to put the links to everything in the show notes as well as on my website.
Okay, great. And if people would like to have autographed copies of my books, they can order them from my website. My last name is Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N, not Martin.
Mm-hmm. As a New Yorker, I have to pronounce it as Martin. No, but
yes, no. I know, and most softy. People do. So some people become confused.
But I'll be sure to make sure that there's no confusion when I post it. And thank you so much for taking the time out of your day, and I really do appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it as well, and it was great speaking with you.